I propose to be the first MC in history who does not say to the audience, this speaker or these speakers need no introduction to this audience. They not only don't need one, they're not going to get one. Ladies and gentlemen, Gary Snyder, Lawrence Berman Gray.
Lawrence and I are going to not break our reading into two separate 50-50 blocks. We're going to do 5 or 10 minutes each, bouncing the points back and forth, and seeing what we suggest to each other in the process of doing this. I would like to speak a little bit about Faye. I know two Fays. I know Faye Abrams, and I know Faye Stender. When I was a student at Reed College in Portland, 1948, my second year at Reed College, 1 year behind me, a young woman entered as a freshman, and that was Faye. Her name was Faye Abrams then. The first time I ever saw her was when she was a freshman and put on one evening a volunteer piano concert. Classical music, exquisite, incredible. You know, she was an amazing pianist already at that time. Later, I got to know her fairly well because she became very close with one of my friends, and we ran around in pretty much the same circles all through those years. Later, several years after that, about in the middle 50s, I was a student at Berkeley in the Graduate School of Oriental Languages, living in a little old garden tool shack back of somebody's house on Hillegas Street. And Faye was in law school then. And she used to come by once in a while, generally completely unexpected, afternoon or night, drop by and just chat. And we had a wonderful friendship of brilliant argumentation. She was always challenging Buddhist metaphysics, which are pretty easy to challenge. But such a pleasure for the wit and the sheer intelligence. And you know, there's nothing like the good company of an intelligent person. There's just nothing like it. Then I went off to live in Asia, to live in Japan, and came back to this country in 68 to meet Faye Stender, who was doing this amazing work. And I had, in a 10-year hiatus, is that how you pronounce it? Hiatus. Ellipse. I had lost touch with what Faye had been doing, of course. And again, was, of course, deeply moved and impressed by the energy, the commitment, the heart, the corazón that she was giving to her work at a time when many of us were putting ourselves out a lot more than people in the United States had put themselves out for some time before or since. But of all of those who were putting themselves out, laying themselves on the line, showing heart, showing compassion, showing energy, taking risks, boy, she was doing it. And she even had time during all of that, 72, I think it was, in the summer, to take off and take off from work down here and come up and help me work on my floor and do carpentry for 3 days up in Nevada County. She's a very good carpenter. So I am honoring Faye Abrams and Faye Stender. And also the impulse that we all share. The work we have all felt drawn to varying degrees over the last 25 years in America, or 30 or however many. The commitment that I think that we all share to turning the society, the ecology, the economic system, the enforced and deliberately transmitted greed and stupidity around. And the work of doing that must go on and will go on whatever level and in whatever area each of us find ourselves drawn to. If it's environmental, somebody's got to do that. If it's social and human, somebody's got to do that. It's not that they run counter to each other or that they draw away from each other. It's not as one friend of mine that I've been in a dialogue with for several years has argued that environmental concerns are elitist. We've got to do people problems. It's not just that. It's that we have to do what we can do where we are. And that's one. And there's another. And there's another. And the totality, the mosaic of those concerns and commitments, if we can keep the energy and the goodwill and the optimism up, and hell, you know, somebody comes and says, I give up on this, we're not going to win. I say, well, whoever said, you know, that whoever promised you're going to win anyway. These are things that we do whether we're going to win or not, like Crazy Horse, charging the wagons. When they had cannons and he had bows and arrows, there are some things you do without asking, will this succeed? And if it isn't going to succeed, I don't want to do it. That's not what we're involved in. We're involved in the latter half of the 20th century, riding into the 21st, when we face the danger of a mass starvation on a planetary scale and perhaps the end of organic evolution in all of the larger mammals. That is to say, there'll be some remnant species in zoos, but organic evolution will come to an end. We face things like that. We all know this. You know, I'm a great doom talker. So all I'm saying is, honor to those who keep working at it, and let us not concern ourselves with whether or not we can expect victory. Let's just do it. So. I want to read a poem by Nanao Sakaki, a wandering Japanese east-west Pacific Basin Upper Paleolithic poet. Nanao, who's close to 60 now, was an Air Force officer in World War II in Japan and was in charge of a little radar base down in southern Kyushu, all of which he spoke of very little to any of us through the years. But last year he wrote a poem and put into the poem some of his senses of World War II and the atom bomb, and I'd like to read that to you. It's called Memorandum. Quote, the whole object of making the weapon is not to kill people, but to find time for somebody to find out other ways to solve these problems. Dr. Norris E. Bradbury, former director of the Los Alamos Laboratory. 1970, Carlsbad Caverns, I was living then. I moved to White Sands National Monument. 1970, Dr. Albert Einstein, government officials and the Pentagon, they all watched a mushroom-shaped cloud right here in the Chihuahua Desert 25 years ago. 1973, I was at Jemez Springs, New Mexico, and there I met a Christian priest. He told me he had been at Tinian Air Force Base in Micronesia and had held a service for the B-29 pilots who headed for Hiroshima that morning, August 6th, 1945. 1945, Izumi Air Base in Japonesia, 100 miles south of Nagasaki. 3 days after the Hiroshima bombing, I caught a B-29 in my radar screen, due north, 30,000 feet high, 300 miles per hour. 3 minutes later, my soldiers shouted, look, a volcanic eruption! In the direction of Nagasaki, I saw the mushroom-shaped cloud with my own eyes. 1946, Hiroshima. There, 1 year after the bombing, I searched for one of my missing friends. As a substitute for him, I found a shadow man. The atomic ray instantly disintegrated his whole body, all but his shadow, which was alive on a concrete wall. 1969. Bandelier National Monument, a beautiful ruin of an ancient people, the Anasazi. Dead of night, the earth quakes 3 times, not by a Hemeth volcano, but by underground nuclear explosions in Los Alamos. More ruins, more churches. 1975, I went back to my old air base, ruins in Japan, south of Nagasaki. No more kamikaze pilots. Now, 3,000 cranes soaring high in the setting sun. 1979. I was at the northern edge of the Chihuahua Desert, the Bosque de la Paz National Wildlife Refuge. Sandhill crane, Grus canadensis, 1700. Whooping crane, Grus americana, none. As a substitute for the extincting species, Mr. Kerr McGee wants to dump ever-existing nuclear waste into the land of enchantment. Donnell has been writing 2 or 3 poems a year for 40 years, which adds up. And I'm collecting them now. I'm going to make a little book of them one of these days. Another thing from Donnell. Georgia O'Keeffe, as you probably have heard, is not a very sociable lady. But her unsociableness is justified and dignified. In fact, I heard a funny story just the other day about how Mrs. Mondale discovered that Georgia O'Keeffe was in the world one day and called up the National Endowment for the Arts and said, I want to meet her. Tell her to be at the Santa Fe, at the Santa Fe airport on such and such a day. She arrived at the Santa Fe airport, no Georgia O'Keeffe. Never did see her. Nanao Sakaki, my friend Nanao, got together with Georgia O'Keeffe. She liked him. He cooked Japanese lunch for her one day and helped her move some things around on her bookshelves. This is a poem that he dedicated to her. It's called Summer Morning Song for Georgia O'Keeffe. On a summer morning, walking in Japanese mountain woods, me, a 16-year-old boy, I met my first love. This round-faced girl, slim body, sharp rayed, gold eyes, not really shy, liked me to look at her, dressed up in green just for me. We met in a high meadow. I called her Mountain Lady, behind a thorn fence, watching her lips blooming in summer morning light. Crossing now many winters, a gray-headed man finds his way to a new continent, walking the woods in the southern Rockies. On another summer morning light, I meet my old love. She's still 16 years old as before, with a round face and an edible root, a native yellow South Asian plant. What a traveler, walking east to Japan, wandering west to the Rockies, without fear, without feet. From my mountain lady's golden face shines out beauty, intelligence, and patience. No beginning, no end to love. Whenever summer meadows bloom back over earth, we meet in a high meadow, weaving a fuzzy globe of starseed cluster and waiting for another summer to set it fly. Don't call my lady oyster plant. For the children. This poem, as some of you might recognize, is based on the curves that were generated by a computer model from MIT in 1970-71. These are the projections to be found in that book that was called The Limits of Growth for the children. The rising hills, the slopes of statistics, lie before us. The steep climb of everything going up, up, as we all go down. In the next century, or the one beyond that, they say, are valleys, pastures. We can meet there in peace if we make it. To climb these coming crests, one word to you and your children. Stay together. Learn the flowers. Go light. Well, I'm going to read a couple more here, and then I'm going to hand it over to you, Lawrence. By golly, it's nice to be reading with Lawrence, too. It's been some years since we've been here together. I'm reading this for the grassroots spirits. The grassroots spirits, spirits of liberal, radical politics in America. I'll tell you a little bit of a story about a couple of these. My father and grandfather were active in working class movements in the Pacific Northwest. In fact, my grandfather, who died when I was still about 7 or 8, the one clear memory I have of him is sitting in his old black chair with a silver flute in his hands, saying to me, "Boy, read Marx." It's a true story. And he told me some of the stories of the old IWW days in the Northwest when they were organizing there. So this is from Myths and Texts, the section called Logging. Felix Baran, Hugo Gerlach, Gustav Johnson, John Looney, Abraham Rabinowitz. Shot down on the steamer Verona for the shingle weavers of Everett, the Everett Massacre, November 5, 1916. Ed McCullough, a logger I worked with, he'd been a logger for 35 years, and reduced by the advent of chainsaws to chopping off knots at the landing. He said, "I don't have to take this kind of shit. Another 20 years and I'll tell him to shove it." He was 65 then. In 1934, they lived in shanties at Hooverville, Sullivan's Gulch. When the Portland-bound train came through, the trainmen tossed off coal for the workers living in the shanties. He said, "Thousands of boys were shot and beat up for wanting a good bed, good pay, decent food in the woods. Nobody knew what it meant. Soldiers of discontent." That's the title of Charlie Ashley's IWW song, Soldiers of Discontent. Kenneth Rexroth told me that he ran into Charlie Ashley in the 40s in a bar in Paris. The guy who had composed the wobbly song Soldiers of Discontent in 1915. So, a ghost logger wanders in the shadows. A ghost logger wanders in the shadows in the early evening. His boots squeak with the cicadas, the fleas, nest warm in his blanket roll. Berry brambles catch at his stagged pants, and he stumbles up the rotted puncheon road. There is a logging camp somewhere in there among the alders, the berries, and the high rotting stumps. Bindle stiff with a wooden bowl. The poor bastards at the shrine of Nimi in the same boat. What old Seattle skid road did he walk from with his hangover 50 years too late and all his money spent?
My grandfather said, read Kropotkin.
I have been one up.
I wish I had a poem written for Face Tender, but I don't. This is the closest thing to it. Close enough. An elegy to dispel gloom, written after the assassinations of Mayor Moscone and Supervisor Harvey Milk in San Francisco, November 78. Let us not sit upon the ground and tell sad stories of the death of sanity. That two sweet men are dead is all that need be said. Two such sentient beings, two humans made of flesh, are meshed in death, and no more need be said. It is pure vanity to think that all humanity be bathed in red because one young madman, one so bad man, lost his head. The force that threw the red fuse drove the bullet does not drive everyone through the city of St. Francis, where there's a breathless hush in the air today, a hush at City Hall, and a hush at the Hall of Justice, a hush in St. Francis Wood, where no bird tries to sing, a hush on the great highway, and in the great harbor, upon the great ships, and on the Embarcadero, from the Mission Rock Resort to the Eagle Cafe, a hush on the great red bridge and on the great gray bridge, a hush in the outer mission and at Hunter's Point, a hush at a hot potato stand on Pier 39, and a hush at the People's Temple where no bird tries its wings, a hush and a weeping at the Convent of the Sacred Heart on Upper Broadway, a hush upon the flesh pots of Lower Broadway, a pall upon the punk rock at Mabo High Gardens, and upon the cafes and bookstores of Old North Beach, a hush upon the landscape of the still Wild West, where two sweet dudes are dead, and no more need be said. Do not sit upon the ground and speak of other senseless murderings and worse disasters waiting in the wings. Do not sit upon the ground and talk of the death of things beyond these sad, sad happenings. Such men as these do rise above our worst imaginings. Two lighter San Francisco poems. Two scavengers in a truck, two beautiful people in a Mercedes. At the stoplight, waiting for the light, 9 a.m. downtown San Francisco, a bright yellow garbage truck with two garbage men in red plastic blazers standing on the back stoop, one on each side hanging on and looking down into an elegant open Mercedes with an elegant couple in it, the man in a hip three-piece linen suit with shoulder-length blonde hair and sunglasses. The young blonde woman, so casually dressed, with a short skirt and colored stockings, on the way to his architect's office. And the two scavengers, up since 4 a.m., grungy from their route, on the way home. The older of the two, with gray iron hair and hunched back, looking down like some gargoyle Quasimodo. And the younger of the two, also with sunglasses and long hair, about the same age as the Mercedes driver. And both scavengers gazing down as from a great distance at the cool couple, as if they were watching some odorless TV ad in which everything is always possible. And the very red light for an instant holding all four close together, as if anything at all were possible between them, across that great gulf in the high seas of this democracy. The billboard painters, the two white-overalled, white-capped sign painters on the high scaffold suspended on the huge billboard beside the elevated freeway, painting a snapshot landscape of a South Sea Island beach with lagoon and coral reef and palm trees through which the sun is setting, and the two white painters painting a sunburned North American couple on the white beach, and the real sun cold over the myriad flashing cars in the middle of San Francisco next to the Hall of Justice. And the two all-white painters struck motionless with arms and paintbrushes raised halfway through the landscape, with the right half painted and the left half still blank, as if the other half of the world had still to be provided for, or as if maybe the creator was changing his or her mind halfway through, as if even he or she was not so certain anymore it was such a good idea after all to have these two so white all-American painters painting this paradise on earth, as if the advertisers who were paying for this sign hadn't already recycled that particular paradise with a jet strip and hotels looking like the American Roman Empire, where they had to advertise now in order to fill those fancy watering places with retired billboard painters who belonged to the union and got themselves and their wives all these benefits like South Sea Island trips after working all their lives in untropical places like San Francisco, which Sir Francis Drake found and wrote back to the head of his empire, saying he had just discovered a real unspoiled native paradise. And if they hurried and put up billboards back home, they might just be able to set up a colony out here with swimming pools and even maybe make a pot of gold or a killing and die happy in a beach chair very far from home.
That's not fair.
That's what I was thinking when he finished.
That's all right.